everybody to the Aris Meyer Podcast. How are you doing today? I have with me a very special guest, a dear brother that I've been spending a couple days with in his secret location. Actually, it's not very secret. We are in Bishop, California at this man's tattoo studio, and we've been hanging out. His name is D-Mart Denaro. How you doing, D-Mart?
How you doing, Aris? I'm doing good.
It's good to see you, man.
Yeah, I am so just grateful you're here. Like, it makes me feel at home here, and it's been a fun couple days so far.
Yeah, we've had a good time, man. We've went out, saw some wilderness.
Yeah, what did we do today?
Did a little tattooing. Saw a raven. We saw all kinds of cool
Razzle
stuff.
Razzle the raven.
Yeah, welcome. Thank you for being on the show. So let's start at the beginning. Tell the people a little bit about your childhood, D-Mart. Where'd you grow up? How many siblings do you have?
My childhood. That's a nice, interesting dreamscape. the easy question, how many siblings? I got three other siblings, so there's a total of four. And then my parents are still together. And so we're a family of six. And I grew up, born and raised in New York, born in White Plains, New York.
All right.
And then I grew up mostly in Tarrytown, but then kind of jumped around. By the time I graduated high school, I had lived in almost 20 plus houses. So kind of like this weird, constantly gypsy-like moving within the same communities, hopping from church to church, houses. And a lot changed when we made a big move from New York to California. But just to kind of stay focused on your question, my childhood was, I guess I say it was a fun dreamscape because it really feels like that. It feels like now where I'm at now in my life, it's like that whole life feels like some dream that I sometimes long for. Sometimes I'm happy to be not in that place in some ways. My childhood feels like an interesting nostalgic dream that I'm also now realizing I'm grateful for my childhood, I guess. But.
Well, tell me about young D-Mart. So you grew up in Tarrytown, and that's Mooneyville. What was it like being a church kid growing up in Tarrytown? Like, did they know you were a Mooney, or did you go to Mooney school, or what was that like?
I definitely went back and forth from hiding my identity from being a Mooney, and at times I was so proud to be a Mooney. I think part of that had to be with the fact that definitely there were certain privileges, I guess, in the sense of like maybe just who I was. Maybe also just, you know, being a male was if you were a male in the church, it was probably like you had a probably better life. My sisters always tell me they had nothing positive to say ever about the church, which is weird because I remember my sister said that to me recently, just last year when I had visited her, and it made me sad, you know, because I have a lot of good memories, but also a lot of weird and bad memories, but.
What kind of kid were you? Were you like an artsy kid? Were you a outdoors kid?
I feel like I was a kid. I feel like I had two childhoods. In New York, my childhood, I was definitely always the quiet kid in both my life in California and in the East Coast. But in the East Coast, I was a wild kid who I was little. I was always made fun of because I was really short and I was skinny, but I was really tough. I was the kid who could play Kill the Carrier, and I was the smallest fucking kid, but you could never take me down.
Like, tank,
I
huh?
was, I was, no, I was just like really, I mean, I was like squirmy, but then I'd get hit, but then I'd be able to land on my hands and like figure, you know, it's like football, like if you get your knee touched on the ground or something like that, you're down. But like, I was able to do some interesting wrestling like moves to stay afloat.
Yeah, so you were kind of tough. You were an athlete.
Maybe so, but I think growing up around a lot of like older church kids, we beat up each other a lot, and in some ways we kind of grew up tough like that in some ways. And fast forward when we made this big move, I won't go into the story right now, but maybe later. But when we moved to California, it was like I didn't know how to make friends. I didn't know what the fuck to do. People would talk to me, I didn't even say anything. And I remember like a vivid memory. I would sit in my English class in Chula Vista, California. If anyone knows where that is, that's actually like 20 minutes away from the Mexican border, right below San Diego. And so it was a complete culture shock. And it was, I mean, to this day, it was beautiful in reflection now. And I'm so grateful that I got to be exposed to that at that age. But when I was there, kind of being uprooted from New York to that town and to that school, in this class, I'd be sitting and there'd be kids saying, like, they'd be poking me, like, talk, say something, say something.
They were like bullying.
And I was just so shy that I just stood frozen staring. And like, there was a voice in my head saying, turn the fuck around and say something, bro. Like, my name's fucking D-Mark. Hello, how you doing? But I just was like in a completely different world. And I think that was actually a lot to do with certain things that were happening in my family, maybe certain just other shit that I wasn't aware of. And I just, my mind just out of survival mode just kind of hit the checkout button. Mm. And it was just wrestling and video games and early discoveries of masturbation and just trying to figure out how the fuck am I gonna be like a normal kid, because I became from extrovert to introvert trying to have someone as a friend or just whatever. It was a weird time. I was hitting like fucking, you know, just I was growing up from 13 to 14. Those are some weird vital times. You know,
those are weird boy years.
Yes.
Yeah. did you make some pretty good friends when you moved to Chula Vista? Did you have like church friends, or like what did your like, what was your kind of community like at the time?
I had so many friends in New York. I didn't even realize that, and until I moved to California, I was like this loner in denial. Like when I was in California for like the first 3 years, which were my last three high school years, I always had this thought, I guess, or feeling, I don't know how it got planted in my head, that this California thing is just temporary and I'm going to eventually move back to New York. And so I never really, it's not that I didn't try to make friends, I think I just, I don't know. I think if there's freeze or flight mode kind of thing, I'm definitely a freeze person, I think. Mm. And that's what I did, I think, for a long time. And I can freeze for a very long time.
And that's when you were in high school, right? Those years?
Yeah, I did ninth grade in New York, Irvington High School. That was the most populated, I guess, school that I knew of, which had a profound number of other church members, Moonies or BCs. However, I go back and forth between the terminologies of say, you know.
But you could say whatever you want. Yeah. People will figure it out.
Yeah. But after ninth grade, it was like that following year, all my friends did a bunch of drugs, and then I came to California, and then it was like, it was this weird, well, I don't know why. I mean, I feel like if I never moved, I would have had a very, very different life. And I feel like, I think I was already kind of like in a weird place in New York, that I probably would have fallen into a realm where I might have experimented with a lot of different things that my friends did, maybe. And at the time, even, I was like envious or jealous. Like, I wanted to do drugs when I was in California, but I had no friends, so I had no access. Mm-hmm. I had like, I don't know. I just wanted to like feel shit, I guess, right? And I was like, what the fuck is it like to get high? And I remember just all these little things that I wanted to do to just escape, you know? And so I think I ended up just doing a lot of different stuff to feel, you know? Whether it's, I don't know, I don't mean to go this dark, but like, you know, whether it's like self-harm or something, mm-hmm. or like burning myself with cigarettes or something like that. It was multifaceted on certain reasons, whether it was based on shame and shit like that. But I feel like I wanted to be myself, but I don't know, maybe I was trying too hard. I just didn't know how to. Or maybe I was just too stubborn in feeling like I don't need to make friends here because I'm going to have my life back when I go back to New York. And then that New York never came around. Is now, well, I'm still here. Actually, I just realized I spent more life, you know, in California and my years here officially than in New York. So.
Wow. So what did you, so you went to high school here and then you graduated high school here?
I went to high school from Irvington High School to Bonita Vista High School to Northwood High School, which is a school in Orange County. And after that, my parents, I was still living with them. We didn't really know what to do with college. That was never really talked about. So I was like, what do I do now? And at the time I was working for Starbucks and I was like, looking at my friends, they were all talking about what colleges they were getting into and they got into, and I was like, what the hell are you talking about? Uh-huh. And I'm like, what? I should have been doing that. I should have been applying for schools. I didn't know that. Nobody told me.
Yeah.
So after I graduated, and then, you know, I went to just the local community colleges, and then I dropped out, I think just that one time first, and I found out another friend of mine from the church in New York was telling me about some fun experiences of a program called OLT, Oceania Leadership Team, which was part of the church. And I was actually stoked on that because it was an opportunity to go to Australia, right? And so it was also an opportunity that, because I actually really wanted to give the church a chance in my life, because quick backstory for people listening or not, whether they are familiar with this church that we're talking about, the Unification Church, my dad left the church, which is why we moved from New York to California. And then by the time I had graduated high school and was my first year of college, my dad started slowly trickling back. And at that point, it was kind of very confusing, not kind of, but maybe very confusing, maybe, or maybe I was just a confused child in general. But through this program, I was like, yeah, you know, I think I want to really give it a chance. But also, I was just 19, and I wanted to explore the world, and I wanted to do that. It was $800, and I was like, fuck yeah. So.
Yeah. What was it? So you went, what was it like in Australia?
Australia was amazing. I will never, ever, ever forget some of the time there. And I do hope to go there one day soon again. I think in due time. Australia was awesome. I mean, I definitely knew what I was getting myself into with a lot of fundraising and things like that. But I think just mentally, I was ready. I put myself in that position to do it. I had heard about my friends going to STF and shit, and I was like, fuck that. I'm not going to ever do shit like that.
I'm glad you
But
didn't
I'm down
that.
To do...
Yeah. It was the fucking worst.
Yeah, Special Task Force versus Oceania Leadership Team. That sounded like a lot more even lighthearted. And... Australia. Maybe I'll just start with some fun stories. Like, I remember. Oh, okay. Well, I won't go into a story, but I will say, Australia was the time when I finally like opened up. Like, by ironically, yes, fundraising sucked, but I have to be so grateful for it because it changed my social life. It made me like not be afraid to talk to people. I knew I had to do this for the mission of God, right? So yeah, I was like, yeah, okay, fucking A, don't turn into a fucking red tomato when you talk to a lady, and just have the confidence and raise money for the church. So I could do it for the church. So it was easy for me to disassociate and remove it and have that higher purpose. So I don't know, I'm easily brainwashed, right? I'm easily persuaded to do things I don't want to do, apparently, in the track record of my life. Yeah, man, I was gung-ho, and so they put me as team leader for a few different, like, quote-unquote conditions and different locations we were sent to, and...
So you went to OLT, and then you were able to kind of learn how to be more vocal, how to express yourself, how to talk to people.
Yes.
During that time... Did you feel like you had kind of reconnected with God in the church? Like, were you like pretty excited about that part of your identity, or how did you feel?
I think when you like truly believe in something, your mind works in some ways where you start manifesting those things that you're trying to genuinely believe in. So, for example, I remember waking up, right? Every morning we woke up, whether it was in a tent or in a van, we would have to read Hunduke, and we would have to read True Father's words, Reverend Moon's words. It's funny because I'm constantly questioning the terminologies I even say all the time.
Well, say whatever you're comfortable with.
Totally. We'd have to read his words, and he'd talk about whatever speeches he would make about fundraising or about like the ocean mission trips of like fishing and stuff. And he said something that was interesting that still stands out into my head, where when you go out fundraising, you must imagine yourself as a beggar. And you must imagine yourself as a beggar of love, to give love to all these people. And essentially, it was like an interesting twisted form of like learning how to have compassion for people who shit on you and tell you to fuck off. I don't want to fucking buy your chocolate bars or your cheap ass Korean bracelets that you're fucking selling for hibbity hoobla for HIV AIDS awareness. What the fuck are you doing in the Solomon Islands? I genuinely like took those words, implanted them into like my fucking heart. And every fucking person I walked up to, like I genuinely try to love them. Like, and I think people just saw that. Maybe they saw just some broken child and they were like, I feel so sorry for you. Here's my money. But in particular, I remember I had a really terrible day and I just turned it around, raised a bunch of money in a couple hours, made the fundraising goal, stoked on life. So stoked that I tried doing a backflip with my team off of a rock, broke my wrist, and then I was like stuck.
That's how you celebrate.
Stuck in the home base of Sydney in Australia, while everyone else was out in vans dispersed into different cities fundraising, and it was just me and two other guys in Sydney. That was bizarre. We were actually forced to do a 7-day fast. Well, I wasn't forced to do a 7-day. There was this kid who got amazing, beautiful human. He actually confessed that he drank. And the rule at that time, they were so serious about it, because the year before that, OLT got shut down because all the kids were partying and drinking. And so they reopened it up with a lot more stricter rules. If you misconduct or get caught drinking, like, you're going to get sent home. And this guy confessed. And they were so, maybe in a way, shocked too. So they gave him a little deal, like, yo, like, either you do a 7-day fast or you gotta go. And we're talking just straight up water, right? And I think just being in the church, that was like, yeah, it was something, but it was also kind of like nothing. Like, everyone was doing it in some ways before blessings and shit, right? So I was just so amped. I was still riding that high of like, this was halfway into the OLT year. And I was like, I'm gonna do it with you, man. I'm gonna do it with you. And then the leader that was like helping impose that same fucking like deal, like 7 days or get the fuck out. He was like, all right, I'm gonna do it too. And so all three of us did a 7-day fast together.
Wow.
And I just remember that was an interesting experience in itself, just having bizarre dreams, your sense of smell going up, but also fundraising as well was a hard experience. But why did I bring that up, that part?
I think because you said you were on the you were injured, and then you were leading up to a story about doing something.
Oh yeah, I was injured, and then following that injury, so here we are talking about like Father's words embracing into me, and I'm trying to exude all these words of wisdom to raise as much money as I can for God, right? So I had a goal. I was like, no one ever broke $1,000. I'm gonna break $1,000, and I did it. I think having a cast really helps.
Please, and, sir. Please.
But I had the whole plan devised in my head, and what mall I was going to exactly hit up and how I was going to do it. I developed a strategy on how to hit up food courts and how to not get caught by security guards. So I became like real like sly with it in some ways, and because I'm an average size human, but at that time I was very skinny and small and easily hideable. Yeah. That was my secret skill. Just put the invisibility cloak on and run away from all your problems. But yeah, a couple things I guess I just will never take away, but that experience in particular, even though it's a bizarre one, it made me realize, holy shit, I can do anything if I truly fucking commit and believe. And as a kid, when I was 19, that was a powerful thing. And then it all came shattering down when I came back home and everything was fucking broken, and I was like, what the fuck is going on? What the fuck's with my family and shit and the church?
Yeah.
So that was a whole nother big downfall. But yeah, at that time, I was in this place where I was definitely riding a high. I remember I was going through my Facebook. And just, you ever do that? Just like go through like way back in your past? And,
well, I get like the Facebook memories things, and it'll be like 2002, you know, whenever.
Sometimes
I joined
those.
In 2007, I forget, but I'll read them, and it's like sometimes it's like churchy stuff, and I'm just ooh. Yeah, is that what you mean?
I remember, well, so I went through like a Facebook memory like thing, and it was this video that popped up when it was a time when we were in on a mission trip through Australia, through OLT on the Solomon Islands, and there was a recording of me speaking in a stadium of people that don't even know English, and I'm speaking English about how much I want to one day have a big dream to be a father. And I watched that film and I was just laughing and also like then crying at the same time.
Damn,
dude. this was like right when the pandemic hit, and I was in a relationship with someone I had been with for 2 months, and she moved in with me into my place at Berkeley with my house, my co-op at the time, with 8 others. And then I showed her that thing, and then I laughed about it, she laughed about it, and then 4 months later we broke up.
I mean, I don't know why I'm laughing, but like, it is, when people that haven't been through that kind of experience see it, they don't know how to process that, you know, like...
Number one, I want to say it's okay to laugh because I think humor is like it's a coping mechanism for
trauma, bro.
Uncomfortable situations, maybe AKA micro trauma, AKA just like, I don't know. I like to always say trauma and then say micro trauma.
Yeah, for sure. So you get out of OLT, you come back home, and then what do you start doing? Do you have like a dream? Do you want to go to college? Do you want to... Like, what was your, did you have something you wanted to do, or were you just home and like, I don't know what to do?
After OLT, it took me maybe like roughly like a year to kind of feel motivated. I even was like, you know, I was looking for a job, and I even like started fundraising on my own. Like door to door in my own town. I was like, I can fundraise here anywhere. I'm gonna try it. And my dad had all like these old laser prints that he used to fundraise with for the church. And I'm sure some of you listening might know what those laser prints look like. But anyways, I remember, I mean, it was definitely a different experience fundraising in Australia versus America, but that lasted maybe like 3 days. I was like, fuck that. Never doing that again. It's just different when you're doing it alone versus a community, right? That's like,
for sure,
united,
for sure,
quote unquote.
I mean, we were taught to do everything as a group, as a community, as a team.
Mm-hmm.
And anything we did for ourselves was like kind of selfish, or you know,
mm-hmm.
we should always be doing something for someone else, even living, you know what I mean?
I was surprised, like it brings up an interesting memory, because like When I was fundraising, you know, before I found a job, at that time in limbo state, I remember, just fast forward, I was in Berkeley for like 8 years, and being on BART, watching just like certain kids go from BART car to BART car with like a little pamphlet saying like, hey, my name's whatever, so-and-so, and just trying to raise some money for my college and da-da-da-da, and I was like, that was fucking me. I did that shit because I was like, and you know, just doing it though, like house to house. But like, you know, it made me have this interesting, I don't know, like in moments like that, like there were weird moments where I would sometimes give money to them and like be like, I would say like, good job, dude, like keep going. And then, I don't know, as I got older, I got more and more just depressed or maybe cynical, and then I stopped giving money.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I stopped seeing myself in them, maybe, or something, right? Or I don't know. But just to go back, not to go on a huge tangent, after OLT, I just had a miraculous decision I got really stoked for some reason to go to Berkeley. Well, not for some reason. I had certain connections there, and I made it a point to go to Berkeley, whether I got into UC Berkeley or not. And it was the only school that I applied to, and I got in. I was fucking stoked. I was actually really proud of myself. That was another, like, maybe big moment in my life, because no one told me to go to college, you know, and in some ways, I technically I'm not the first person in my family to go to college, because my dad went to college after he left the church, but he's like still paying his debt off and things like that. But yeah, I don't know. I feel good because it was just more like I was doing shitty in community college, and I wanted to bust. Like it was, I found another goal or a reason for me to pursue something again beyond myself. But yeah, maybe we can.
When you started to when did you start getting into art?
Ooh. Oh yeah. So okay, Berkeley. I was stoked about Berkeley because I found out you can make your own major in Berkeley. So simultaneously, what was happening was like a whole spiritual deconstruction of the church when I came back from OLT, and I was trying to essentially find myself again. And a little bit before, like a little bit pre going to OLT, I had discovered concepts of like lucid dreaming and meditation and other like unique, I guess, gateways to quote unquote like spirituality or the spirit or something just beyond. And that always just oddly intrigued me. And I found out that in Berkeley, this hippie lovey-dovey school that I had visited once because I was in coffee and my coffee boss had sent me there, and I was just like, I just felt really connected at the time to just the energy. Or maybe it was just a completely different city and I was like, holy shit, I want to be here, because it was new. And I found out you can make your own major, and I decided I wanted to make a major about art and visual art and dreaming, but specifically like lucid dreaming. And so like, what did that look like? It looked like having for me to take like psychology courses, maybe some like neuroscience courses and a bunch of art courses, and eventually frame something to then write a thesis for this like new intended major, which maybe would have been something like art therapy or something like that. And when I was applying to Berkeley, I remember the essays were really big, the personal statements of why you want to go into school, what is your intended major and why. And I was pretty proud of my first line, but in some ways it's kind of like, I don't know, maybe I'm being too self-victimizing or something like that, but it was when I was 13, my father told me my art sucked, and I never really made art again until after. I mean, I made art in like mandatory high school art classes and shit, but I pretty much got re-inspired in the midst of then needing to try hard to go into Berkeley. And this is a terrible story. I'm telling it totally chronologically off, because I guess that's just the way it is. But there's just so much to share, you know? It's such an exciting thing. There's so many, like, we already shared so many stories in these past couple of days, but then there's all these other stories that as you're asking me these questions, you're like reopening my mind. It's like, holy shit, my brain, I still have these memories accessed that I almost forgot about. I was talking about like being really intrigued by like spirituality and stuff and lucid dreaming. And one of the community college classes that helped me get motivated to go back to school and try to go to a university was this one art class called experimental painting. And I was like, what's that about? So I take that class, sit down for the first day, and on the fucking whiteboards in giant letters is the question, where do you stand? ? Ooh. And then, where do you stand as an artist? ? And I was like, you know, I was like, huh, what's this about, you know? And he starts talking, and he's showing us all these like really cool documentaries of all these rad artists and things, and I was just like blown away at like, holy shit, art is something beyond just a pretty picture. Because I felt like when I was a kid, I was criticized, you know, just for like my art not looking good, like not looking good like everybody else's, right? Like I was in this accelerated art class that I got in seventh grade in middle school. And it was like at the end of the year, there's like an art show, all the parents come out, and it was a fun class. I was just having fun. And you put up your work, and some of the stuff, it was just half-assed, right? And I didn't really, you know, the teacher didn't really give us too much guidance on how to set it up. Just put up your work, if you're proud of it, whatever. And my dad just, you know, when he went to the show, essentially he was just like, what the fuck is this? You know, comparing my work to other people's things. And I just stopped after that. I mean, I definitely cried. I didn't really even know like why I was crying, but I mean, to this day, like I still talk with my dad here and there, but it's, you know, I know he deeply, I mean, he didn't mean it, right? But it still impacted me to the point where I couldn't help it either. Like, I know he didn't mean it, and yeah. I know he was apologetic and also, you know, sorry that he had said that the next couple days, but unconsciously, I still like judged every fucking thing I drew or made, right? I was like, oh, that's shit, you know? And so having this profound experimental painting class in community college, it just like helped me realize that it is beyond just a pretty picture. Art is so much more. And that was just enough for me to be like, there is, and I know it, because I know it. And especially through just my journey of just trying to practice and explore lucid dreaming and other things, I was like, this is it. I'm going, and I'm going no matter if I get into this UC Berkeley or not. And in a way, that was like my reincarnation of my life as a giant fuck up. No. I don't know, it's still a constant journey of me trying to like love myself and appreciate, I guess, my work. And I mean, I really feel like now, like just where I stand a little bit more, and like why I make art, in a little bit more confidence. And I have to say that every day, because every day in the past I was saying I suck, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like this weird, you know, as cliche as it is, I have to say like, no, like you're doing important work, stay true to yourself, stay healthy, you know, and just keep making work and just trust.
When you were experimenting and learning about different religions and philosophies, were there any that really resonated with you? Like, did you ever find a path in those, or how did you?
Yeah, do? I feel like a light dabble maybe, but I definitely was drawn to certain Buddhist practices. I don't want to say I didn't necessarily deep delve into like going to certain like meditation centers or things like that. Although I did go to a 3-day silent retreat. I never did like a 7-day one, but maybe Buddhism, mostly Buddhism, I would say. And maybe because it just felt like that was the most, it just was like the most like neutral, like there was like the least amount of rules, everything was love, and it was all about just trying to be happy. And it was like, I was like, yeah, this is amazing. Like this is what fucking, like, I don't know, like saving the world should be about, not about just some intense shit that has just confused the fuck out of me. I don't know.
Yeah. Man. So the things I know about you, and maybe you can help fill in the blanks here. I know that you're an artist. I know that you're an avid rock climber. And I know that you're a tattoo artist. I also know that you made film for a while, made kind of movies. So how did those things come about, in your journey? Like, what was the evolution of those things?
Well, I think deep down I kind of want to like tell a story. I never really spoke up in my life. I was always the quiet kid, and so like my voice, it was never like my skill. Like some people have like a really good voice, right? And like, wow, like that, like you should do that. You should do something with that, right?
D-Mart looked directly at me when he said that.
For me, I'm very insecure with my voice. And so maybe naturally, subconsciously, my voice became through my art. But that was still hard because I thought it sucked, right? But tying that, kind of all the things that I love, and just by doing them, I'm naturally realizing I keep feeling like I want to share stuff with the world, but I'm also like too afraid to share the actual things. And learning kind of like what I did in the art world is like, you don't necessarily have to share all that deep, dark shit. Like that's not maybe necessarily important, but there's ways to like, stuff that I'm so grateful that I learned in art school is like, there's ways to like dissect like the essence of what you need to share. And there's ways to dissect like the essence of what you need to share, whether it's something that needs to be, I don't know, expressed because there was maybe some trauma in your life or something, or just some grand experience that needs to be like vomited out or just put out into the world. And I think just grateful for school and education within the arts to learn how to frame certain things that happened in my life to then put it out in a different form. And in some ways it's very therapeutic. And I'm realizing as I'm getting older, still there's a lot of issues and a lot of family things that I'm still unfolding. And I wanted to kind of share like stories. And I remember I was in community college and I was first, my first intended major before it was art, was film. And I made some depressing movies, man. I made a fucking movie about my brother dying, and that was the fucking movie. And I was over it was and then like the film started out in the premise of like me at the dinner table with my parents, you know, and talking about trying to visit his grave. And it's funny because I don't know, as I'm talking right now, it's like I'm questioning why I'm saying shit, like, and I'm constantly in my head about what the fuck am I saying. But anyways, you're gonna have to remind me of your questionnaires, because it was a big question that can go multiple ways. So I feel like I'm now needing some help and guidance from you, sir.
I want to know more about this film that you were making and why you decided to make it. Why did you decide to make this film about your brother dying?
Oh shit, that's a good one. I didn't even think I was going to talk about that one, but it just came out. I don't know. I think, I mean, maybe everything that we do, right, is in some ways like a self-projection. And maybe at the time I felt like, maybe it wasn't necessarily like my brother who was dead, but it was like, in some ways, a part of me that felt like was dead, and I wanted to like commemorate or honor that. And I think that was maybe in some ways this like feeling of like longing for my past community. At that point, I think I realized like New York is never coming back, and it's been like 5-6 years, you know, since New York, and like now your life's in California. And I don't know, I just felt like robbed of like this whole life that I actually wanted, but I never spoke up to my parents. I actually had like one opportunity to go back to New York, but I didn't want to do it because then it would have just been me. So I just, I don't know. I think a lot of kids can relate just with the whole church kind of collapsing as a whole, right? We feel like we're still in this weird, we just woke up from this fucking weird dream and now we're all like longing for something.
I remember you told me one of your art projects was called Moon Children. Uh-huh. And I didn't really understand it at first. It was a lot of that kind of these drawings of creatures and it was called Moon Children.
Uh-huh.
And I asked you, was like, this related to the church? And you were like, no, not really. And then you explained to me what it was. And what you just said kind of reminded me of what it was. Could you tell the people about Moon Children and your inspiration and what it is?
Yeah, definitely. Moon Children started out as actually just as a general drawing practice that I highly recommend to a lot of people. It came out through, like, if you're familiar with automatic writing, which is essentially like free flow writing, just let your unconscious flow out and don't think about it, just fucking write whatever on paper. Just go for like a certain amount of time, whatever you want to set, maybe like 10 minutes, 20 minutes. And you can do the same for drawing. So you just don't think, just hold whatever tool in your hand, pencil, pen, brush, whatever, and just go. Make shapes, patterns, whatever you do. If you notice you're making something, that's fine. If you want to make it into an image, that's fine. But the idea is to kind of come back to just let your brain just make these abstract shapes or whatever. And the Moon Children evolved from a pattern that my hand was moving at, maybe from a very anxious manner, right? Because I'm making like these very shaky etching-like markings just with the ballpoint pen. And I noticed I would repeat that pattern a lot. And slowly, unconsciously, it turned into a shape of this like floating figure that I seemed to then just repeat because I that shape appealed to me. I liked it and it looked kind of cool. I think really it was a reflection of where I was at in the state of my life where I just looked like this floating figure drifting in space to and fro something. And Moon Children now, I draw them within like, whether it's a singular Moon Children or they're usually in my drawings as like these free-flowing figures. They look like they're going to the moon or away from the moon. And I remember a good friend of mine in the Bay was like, oh, haha, like Moon Children because of like the Moonies, right? And I was genuinely like, oh shit. Yeah, weird, yeah. And then I just thought about it a little bit more. And, well, actually, I'm sorry, I take that back. They were not called the Moon Children at that time. I was drawing them and someone asked me, what are those figures? And then I just said, I don't know, Moon Children. And then that name just kind of stuck. And at the time I was dating someone who was like super into astrology and I was all about the moon and different signs and shit.
I bet you were.
And then, yeah, so when my friend asked me that question, and it was actually more profound than it, I thought about it as like us from being in the church and then all of a sudden, boom, feeling displaced and lost and all our friends are like Dragon Ball Z balls dispersed into the world and I don't know. Nah, so the Moon Children then, I was taught through, I guess, academic education or through art school in Berkeley, which I think, well, quick backstory, Berkeley is a unique school because it's definitely a lot more like concept driven versus like technical skills for like art, which I appreciated. But I always was taught to do things in like a series, like you do one thing and stick with it and see how it evolves. And so I kept making these and I was really committed and I did the Moon Children stuff in all shapes and different forms. I did a little project where I tried to travel with them. I even reenacted like an OLT fundraising condition where I went to Japan for 40 days and tried to make all Moon Children art, all originals, and I would use that. And whatever fundraising I would make, that was the money I would pay for a hostel and my food. And it was dope.
That's
I ended up spending like $300 total for the 40 days that I was in Japan. It wasn't about like making money. It was just about seeing if I can, you know, get by and travel around. And that was awesome. So the moon, and anyways, yeah, the moon children, they saved me. They did many things. They did a lot of things, I think, for me and in my growth, I think, as an artist in an important time.
Yeah. Rock climbing. I know mm-hmm. that you're really big into. Is it called bouldering, rock climbing? I have no idea.
Total. I mean, rock climbing is like the bouldering is under the bigger umbrella of just rock climbing in general, right? Bouldering specifically, I do mostly because I guess when I got into rock climbing a lot, I mostly just did it alone. And so usually rock climbing, you need like partners and stuff and rope and stuff. And I, you know, as I got into the sport, I was just like, wow, there's some, you gotta buy this, you gotta buy that. And I was like, fuck, I just wanna buy the shoes. They're already expensive enough. And I was like, yeah, I'm fucking tough. If I fall, I fall, whatever. Wow. If I was 20 feet, whatever, fine. Yeah. I jumped off buildings before that, higher than that.
Did backflips.
So I felt like I already had like these cat-like reflexes to fall and shit. And taking karate classes from the church. Thank the church.
What was it called?
Juanjuado. And then turned into Tongil Mudo.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I was in nothing belt. I went one time and that was that.
Tongil, baby. Unity. never mind. The fuck am I talking about? Brown belt means nothing. You're gonna please erase that part. I don't want to talk about brown belt. Yeah,
your brown belt. I'm not.
I'm just kidding.
Okay, so as a brown belt, no, just kidding. What is it about rock climbing that is important to you? Because I know it's something that you do a lot, and it seems like a practice in your life.
Well, I've always loved sports in my life. Like when I was born, my father was trying to like. To his capacity, try and like breed me to be a baseball player.
Really?
My grandfather was going to be a professional Boston Red Sox player as a catcher. And then he got married, and then all those dreams came crashing down. No, but that's the story that I hear from my dad, so I'm just repeating it. But I think there could have been something, some kind of pressure, and then he ended up not taking it and not going with it. So I was playing baseball, and then it was fun, and I just was never, I don't know, I just. Something turned me off deeply to the sport, and I think it was the fact that it was a team sport. And again, I'm not the best communicator because I don't know how to speak up. And a lot of baseball is highly communicative dependent.
Yeah.
And I ended up falling in love. I went from baseball. I love football. I still always do. But I ended up wrestling for a long time in high school. And then after wrestling was over, I found rock climbing. I think if I had been introduced to rock climbing at a younger age, though, for sure, I think I would have loved it. Because I was just never exposed to it. The first time I was exposed to a climbing gym was in Australia. And then when I came back from Australia, I eventually got a coffee job, and I found out this little like bouldering like outdoor gear shop was opening up right next door, and they had like a little tiny ass bouldering wall. And it was meant mostly for you, so you could like practice and like see how your shoes fit and feel to like be on the wall. Mm-hmm. But the people there, they had set some problems and they graded it, and I was like, whoa, this is a whole fucking new fucking thing. And I actually like always, like I loved climbing stuff, and so it was very like natural to me. And the rest is it, man. I just fell in love. And eventually, I found out about this place where we're at right now, and it was through climbing. This place, Bishop, California, tiny town, 5,000 people with a very interesting, dark history. I think just watched, there was just like a lot of people in the Bay Area just talked about this place, and eventually I found myself there for the first time in 2016. And then I visited again in like 2018, and then I was like, I'm moving here now. Wow. And then, there's a climbing, there's a quote unquote, there's like these things called bouldering projects or bouldering problems, and people give them like names and stuff. And I saw that there was this one boulder problem, and the name was called lucid dreaming. And I didn't even know what the fuck it was or how hard it was, but I was like, I want to see what that looks like. And then I ended up looking at the videos for it on YouTube, and it's like one of the hardest boulders in the world. And I was like a fool. I was like, I'm gonna fucking train for that and do it. I'm gonna fucking do it. And no one, I mean, yeah, I'm a fucking fool. It's like impossible, but whatever, right? Like, have high, crazy goals, but it's really about. And anyways, it brought me here. And
have you climbed Lucid Dreaming?
No, not even. I mean, I've tried. It's like, it's a really silly. If I were to bring you there, which I want to show you tomorrow, It's like the most fucking contrived looking. Like, why would you need to do that? Like, you don't need to do that. It's not. I mean, the boulder itself is very beautifully aesthetic, and actually, the story of where that boulder is at is within a very sacred Native Indigenous area. Anyways, this whole area, Bishop, California, aka Payahunadu, is the native name, the land of flowing water. Quick backstory, all of the water to LA comes from here.
Oh, thank
amongst
you.
Now amongst other places too now, but that area, it's known as the buttermilks within the climbing world. There are these two giant boulders, like 60 feet tall. They're known as the Grandma and the Grandpa Peabody. And within that space, the story goes, supposedly the Native American Paiute tribe had like sacred ceremonies and weddings there. And just learning things like that, just even learning of like the Native history here, there was just like a lot of complexity and richness that I felt oddly connected to, drawn to, whatever it was. It's like some weird vortex that felt like I needed to be here.
There's definitely an energy here. I mean, the last couple of days being here with you, going in nature, you can feel something here that's special or different. Mm-hmm. And the nature that's around here, the specific areas, are so like transcendent, like they're so unique that I could definitely understand how they could be a special spiritual place.
Totally. Whenever I leave here, whether it's for like a small trip or I feel like the city kid in me still needs some city and I leave, but then when I come back, I'm just like, oh my God, I'm so grateful I live here. Like, it's sometimes, right, like we both talk about this, like hating, like to be alone and stuff. Like sometimes it can definitely feel very alone here. And I don't know if that's just a problem I have in general, whether it's whatever location. But I feel so happy. I think just like within this pandemic here, year of having this space and like, having my friends come out to visit me and stuff, it's like, I don't know. I feel so grateful and like honored. And like, I want to like for once not move every year and like be grounded. Mm. And I think I said this before, but like every year I would move as a kid. And I mean, even like in Berkeley, I was there for like 8 years, but I was always like fucking pinballing. Boom, 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 boom. And I mean, I probably still do that, but like I feel like, and I still probably always will do that, but like the sense of, it's always with like the question mark of like, where will my home be? Mm. And I do feel like I want to be grounded here. It's interesting. I don't know. I constantly question every time I speak. Like I say these things and I'm like, how come I speak with such a uncertainty?
since I've been here, you work in a really cool coffee shop, and something that I've learned about you is that you have a very deep relationship with coffee.
Uh-huh.
Even through just the stories you've been telling, you've been like casually mentioning, I worked at a coffee shop, I worked at a coffee job. What is your relationship with coffee?
Ask me again.
What is your relationship with coffee?
My relationship with coffee is evolved. I have so much love and gratitude for coffee because it's brought me and exposed me to a sense of like so many different, it's brought me to so many different countries. I don't even know how to answer that. What is my relationship to coffee? I mean, I love coffee, but it's not because I like love to drink coffee.
Mm-hmm.
I love coffee because it's taught me so much about how the world works. It's not, I mean, it's just about like the legality of things. Everyone fucking drinks it, and it's an intense drug, you know. It's interesting, but also just like the way it was brought to the world, you know, through dark history of colonization, and most of the coffee farms built, you know, were from slavery, and learning about coffee, it was weird to be super interested in coffee first, because I was interested in it specifically through an artistic lens, because I was like, whoa, you can make like crazy fucking patterns and shit on lattes and stuff, right? And I discovered that on YouTube when I was still working for Starbucks. And when I went to Australia, I was exposed to a whole world of like specialty coffee over there, because Australia has a very different coffee culture. So when I came back to America, I was like, I want to work for a fucking fancy coffee shop like that. And then I did. And then eventually a lot of years passed, worked with many different companies, watched them grow. Some big time companies too. And they, just seeing the way we talked about coffee, about how coffees are ethically sourced, but all of this is just used as like an interesting marketing scheme. And like, yes, specialty coffee is paid at a premium and a higher price, and more does go back to the farmer, but there's still like so many lines of like bullshit. Yeah. Of like, okay, how much do you actually care about your relationship with your farmer that you say you have such a good relationship with, but you don't even know the name of the farmer or something like that? And I feel like I've become just too critical. I've become too fucking hard on like other companies I've worked for and shit, to the point where it's like, okay, well, fucking, why don't you just do it? Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe I'm really stubborn or something, or just hard on like other companies because I'm hard on myself, or maybe my standard is just fucking too high or something. And I now find myself like still in coffee, because it's something I love. It's something I love doing and connecting with people to give like a beautiful drink or beverage to someone and to make someone's day. And it makes me oddly feel like, because I've done it so long, it makes me feel like sane. Like I feel good in a coffee shop. And I've had many like art projects that I've wanted to culminate and combine with coffee, I guess. And that was a huge struggle of like, how do I combine my art life with my coffee life?
I remember when I came here, you work in a coffee shop, and I'm a novice when it comes to coffee. I don't know much. And you were telling me about how coffee comes from a berry, because you have some art here in your studio, and there are tattoos of like, you know, like branches and berries.
Yeah.
And you were kind of explaining to me how it's farmed, how coffee is made, how different roasts are made. And you were telling me about how, I mean, you've almost witnessed, well, you have witnessed firsthand the entire process of coffee, from literally going to the countries it's made in, mm-hmm. to how it's sold, to how it's packaged, mm-hmm. to how it's purposed, to how it's brought, you know,
yep.
To basically my cup. Mm-hmm. And
the underlying... It's known in the coffee world as the seed to cup process.
Yeah. But. Well, the underlying thing to me that really stood out, that I thought was eye-opening, was how something so pure and beautiful was just completely fucked by capitalism and greed. I mm-hmm. mean, when you walk into a coffee shop and they have pictures of, you know, farmers in Honduras or wherever, and they're like, mm-hmm. this is where it's from, this is what you're getting. The reality of that was made very clear to me by you, that it's not like such a... it's not a partnership, you know what I mean? It's just like a corporate way of making it's us like feel a, good about the
yeah.
product.
The cynic in me is saying it's like a facade of a partnership in some ways, but maybe that's a too, it's being a little harsh. Because I think the reality is like, yeah, like we're all just trying to make some fucking money to survive for our own families, right? And those farmers are just doing what they gotta do to put food on the table for their kids. And in the same scope of life here, you know, maybe the value of our dollar is higher, but like, there's everyone, I think, struggles. So it's like, we all want to do like good things and the right thing. And even as I'm talking to you about this coffee thing, like I'm just having this weird mindfuck reflection of this. Like, I'm a fucking hard ass on
No, but I think because you're an expert, when a layperson like me asks you, it helps us to form a fuller opinion or see more clearly the reality of how capitalism is moving and shaping every aspect of our life. Whether it's something that we imagine as an idealist to be pure and good or bad, it's a total manipulation. And I think your expertise really helped clear that up for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to stop drinking coffee. I fucking love coffee.
No, right?
But
yeah.
There's so many things that you're passionate about, and I feel like when you start talking about them, it's very refreshing because you don't just do things on the surface level. Like, I feel like there's always layers to your work and your interests. And
totally. I think the biggest aha moment, like you said too, like today, being able to receive education and understanding that, oh yeah, coffee comes, it's a fruit. It is a fruit that comes from a tropical tree, mostly grown on the equator. And like, just even that fucking piece of knowledge that I take for granted now, right? That I don't even realize that there's still a plethora, a huge percentage of people in the world that have no idea, because we're so disconnected to that source of origin of like, oh, this is a plant-based thing that was harvested from a tree and then, you know, washed or dried or however it's processed, brought to whatever roaster, roasted, ground, brewed, and then in your cup. But as consumers, we're so disconnected from that, where it comes from. We say, oh, this is, you know, like Starbucks coffee is the best coffee. But like, some people have just, I mean, I don't know. I'm not making sense right now. But what I'm trying to say is, when I discovered myself, that like aha like moment of like, oh wow, coffee is a fruit, it comes from a tree, and it brought me to a place to understand that we're just disconnected from nature. I mean, we had this conversation earlier today about like being just removed from nature. We don't know any, like, a lot of the things that, you know, people knew in the past, indigenous people knew in the past. Like, there's a lot of knowledge that's just lost. I'm terrible right now.
No, I think what you're saying makes sense. And for me, it was eye-opening to, like, the reality of colonialism and erasing the sources of things and thinking they're brought to you specifically by the West or
a corporate company like Starbucks, yeah, right, or something like that.
But the reality is they're brought to us from the fucking earth. They're, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're brought to us from the people.
Okay. So that's, I remember now what I wanted to like full circle with is like realizing that this was brought from the earth and that something from the earth, as magical as coffee, like what is this magical berry that has these magical potency of this drug called caffeine that gives us energy and it gives us creativity, it gives us like this amazing desire to connect and network and talk with people, and it's a fucking beautiful drug.
It is
and,
really the
and,
best.
And right, everything in balance, right? But it can be so easily tainted, just like anything. And like, I had a job where I was this coffee educator, and like the biggest thing I preached was like, look, if you're not happy with that shot you made or the coffee that you brewed for this customer, like look, and it's a giant rush and like there's so much happening and like, you know, that shot might not be amazing, but it's like definitely still servable, but not to like quote unquote our standards, like it's okay, like just like it's, give it like serve it with like love. Like, be happy. Don't like serve it like, oh, here's your latte, it's not gonna be so good, I'm so sorry, please let me know, I'll totally remake it. No, like that might be their first cup of fucking coffee of the day. They're just stoked to have something in their system. You don't know what walk of life they're coming from. They're just fucking grateful that they're gonna finally get this coffee. And so when you give it to them, they're going to like feel that love and joy if you can be like that. But if you give it to them in an insecure way, they're going to be like, you know, what the hell are you doing? You know, this is a, you know, we're all, it's funny because like in some ways, like working behind a register of a coffee bar, you realize you're serving a lot of people who are from all over, some of them are, you know, genuine addicts. And like, I have learned how to just, even like maybe through fundraising, learned how to like calibrate on someone's level and then fucking make their day with giving them a beautiful drink.
Yeah.
And I talk about like the transference of energy. So like the specialty coffee shops that talk about the transparency of all the hands that touch the coffee from the picker to the middleman of the person then importing it to the roaster. Like any person that touches that coffee and there's some bad juju on it, or if they're like, fuck it, whatever, like, let's just keep going, we got to do it. Like, there's gonna be a taste in there that you can sense. Like, coffee is super sensitive. It's a fermented fruit and it picks up a lot of things, including energy, in my belief. And anyways, it's just like, I don't know. If you serve coffee, or I don't know, if someone gives you coffee and they're like a shitty, pretentious asshole to you because you like wanted some cream it or something, right? You're like, oh, like, you know, we live in this weird culture now. If you like live in LA, if you put cream in your coffee, you're like frowned upon, right?
Yeah,
not,
that's me,
not, not now, but yeah, but
that's me.
I mean, times are, but like, but it's just, you know, it was this, that was a funny time in the wave of coffee, like where that whole pretentious barista whole like thing came out. But, and I tried my best to help people say like, you could do whatever you your coffee. Like, if you're going to be a shitty asshole to that person, and then they're like, all they're going to taste is shitty asshole in their coffee. Mm. Like, they're not going to taste those flowery fruit flop notes of blueberry and jasmine tea and da 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 da. And like those shit, that like that stuff does exist, but the moment you like criticize someone or project on someone or belittle them or whatever, like taste is such an intimate thing that that shit will shut down. And I'm talking in a very scattered way because this coffee question definitely caught me off guard, but because I realized how big of a conversation it can be, and I think that's why I was so drawn to making art about it. And and in some ways I still am, you know.
The last question I want to ask you before we move on to the lightning round is about tattooing. Part of my journey here was to get my first tattoo ever from you. I've never had one before. Grew up in the church, very puritanical, not something that was, you know, told or encouraged, rather.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I wanted it to be an experience with someone special that I could share a connection with, that could help create something that would be on me forever. And I know that, I knew that you, amongst other people, was tattooing. How did that journey start for you, and what does tattooing mean to you?
Mm. So after I graduated Berkeley, I decided to get into tattooing. It was like, well, I got a degree in art. What do? Work at a coffee shop, right? And so I did that, and I started looking out. I tried doing things, quote unquote, like the right way, and seeking for an apprenticeship. So I had my fundraising skills and I hunted down many tattoo shops in the Bay Area. You know, some of them I made a fool of myself, and some of them I really had really good, amazing conversations with. And one of them, to which she never took me in as an apprentice, but I still look at her as a huge mentor. And in some ways I had like an apprenticeship like experience with her. It was, I don't know, to this day, like, we still talk. And hopefully I'll be guesting there in the very near future. But I have a really good friend who I had met in community college. She was the first tattoo artist I ever met in my life. And she was this Hapa I thought she was a Mooney. I was like, is she a Mooney?
She's half, she's that's half. The first, that's always the first whenever you see a person.
But she was just this badass woman, kind of like, she always wore black, kind of like, she was talking to me, and she was talking about how she has this apprenticeship, and she was like, oh yeah, you want a free tattoo? And I was just like, hell yeah. And I just felt so grateful that I got to meet somebody like that, that was like in the non-stereotype of who a tattoo artist, like this rough and tough, kind of like, that kind of macho kind of culture, right? Maybe kind of thing. And anyways, we stayed, we ended up ironically both getting into Berkeley. And so we stay connected. Then I graduate, she graduates, and I'm just then kind of figuring out, seeking an apprenticeship, and I end up just buying my own equipment. Actually, I do want to tell a small story. I'm so sorry.
No, man, the people are here for DMART, man. Lay it on.
So this woman in Berkeley called Sacred Rose, she was the first female to own a tattoo shop in Berkeley. She's badass. She's also like a Buddhist at heart, which is why I was also super drawn to her. And I must have gone in like 4 times. And the last time I finally genuinely believed that she wouldn't take me. And one of the days I was like, look, what the fuck do I have to do? Like, what do you want? Like, I want to like work with you. And, you know, I've done these drawing assignments. You've asked me to do this. You asked me to do that. And she looks at me straight in the eye and she goes, DMAR, remember that one time I told you, like, whatever you do, don't ever go and buy your own shit off the internet and try and tattoo yourself and learn that way. And what did you do? You went out and did that, and you fucking showed me the tattoo of a tiger you did on yourself on your leg. And I was like, she was like, I don't give a fuck how good you are at drawing or tattooing. Can you listen to my words? And I was just like, mind blown, like truly humbling fucking experience. Cause I was just so insecure of like not being good enough, right? And so that was a huge like wake up moment. And she genuinely said that same fucking day, she was like, look, you show me these tattoos and other ones you did, like you can do this on your own. Like, I believe in you. Like, you got the skills to like pursue this, but like now you've chosen your own path to do this. So like, I will help you. Like, I want to help you just through conversation. We're friends, you know, we know each other. I've tattooed you a few times. Like, it's going to be okay. I mean, it was just weird. I felt like she was like this amazing, supportive, like motherly, like almost figure in my life, like the only adult parent, like supporting me in some ways, even though I didn't like do what she said. And, I'm so grateful for that. I actually did have an apprenticeship, though. Like, a few years later, I had an apprenticeship in the Castro. I quit within, like, 3 months of that. So my journey with tattooing has definitely been back and forth, full of imposter syndrome, because I'm pretty much self-taught. Like, most of my information is through YouTube, through hitting up some homies that I knew tattooed, and like some of the shit they said over to me over the phone, like I still remember, like, always pull a line in towards you, you know, don't ever do this, and don't ever go over a line more than like 3 times, like stuff that I like was like, you know, like, oh my god, yes, like I will listen to any bit of information as like godlike, because I know nothing and I trust you, because I looked up to them, right? Tattooing to me now has insanely evolved in this year of the pandemic. When I got the opportunity to be in this studio here, I thought deeply about what I wanted to do. I genuinely also thought deeply about, like, should I continue to tattoo? Because, like, I've had people, like, literally threaten to call the cops on me and shit like that. Like, I remember I was trying to guess at this one spot, and I was telling them, like, I'm going to renew my Bloodborne Pathing certification. And when they told me that, like, I just transparently told them, like, I'm going to renew. It's a fucking, like, thing equivalent to, like, a food handler safety card. Anyone can fucking take this certification test for $40 online or less and be certified. Now, this is just for California, though. There's different, like, rules in different states to be a tattoo artist. But So yeah, I was like genuinely like, I don't like to start shit. I'm like conflict avoidant. So I had like a lot of like fear and anxiety and stress from just tattooing, you know, but I was still just drawn to it, and it kept coming back. It kept like poking and like I kept at it. And when I was in this space thinking about what to do, I don't really know how it came about, but I just had this idea to do another thing with the number 40. I tend to do art projects related to the number 40, whether it's 40 days or something. Definitely church related, mm-hmm. but as like a means of intention to transform or to evolve. And the 40 Moths project was a huge thing, and it was definitely a lot more of a bigger project than it was intended to be, but it has caused a really beautiful and grateful like evolution to understand in some ways like this is super important to me. Mm-hmm. And like I don't give a fuck what anyone says, and I don't even care how bad the Moths end up being or whatever. Like my genuine intention is to bring awareness to our connection with nature, but more specifically with Moths, our ancestors. And in a lot of cultures still today believe Moths and butterflies have very deep like spiritual connections beyond just their purpose in nature to pollinate plants and other flowers and things like that. Like there is a genuine, or not genuine, that's the wrong word. There is a deep connection with nature that we just are totally disconnected to, that we have lost. And it's really important, I think, to like listen to those weird, almost goosebump like feelings. Like I had a very strange experience with a white moth in the past, which has sparked other art projects related to moths, and then now this 40 Moth project as tattoos, that has caused me to be like, that was so profound that I need to make art about this. Mm-hmm. And explore this and research this. And it's kind of like why I love art too. It can be something visually beautiful, or it can be music or whatever, but it's another way to understand the world around us. It's like another language of like science, right? Science in the world is a means to understand like things, and art is just like more data to help us understand that. And I mean, that's just one perception of art, but tattooing to me has become so powerfully important because number one, it gets me out of my bed now.
All right. Well, thank you for taking this time to talk to me. Now we're moving on to the lightning round. These are some hard-hitting questions. You can let your guard down a little bit.
Okay.
We're going to freestyle them. So I'll give you an easy one first. If you... None of them are easy, bro. So there was a time in your life when you were making movies. You're still kind of making movies. You're getting back to making a mixture of like your art, current and past, in your short films, like on Instagram and stuff. If you could make a movie about anything, what would you make a movie about?
You hear that noise? That. Nothing. No, that was terrible.
It's going to be a French film then. That's. You could pass on questions too.
Damn, dude, what kind of movie would I make?
This is the lightning round, bro.
I know. It's got to be fast, dude. I don't know. I actually stopped myself from the first thing that came to my head. I wanted to make a movie. I don't know why I'm so, I don't know, shy. I guess I don't realize how vulnerable I am. But I guess I would make a movie about my dad.
About your dad? Yeah. Good answer. All right. If you could tattoo anyone, who would you tattoo and what would you put on them?
Oh my god. If my mom ever gave me the permission to tattoo her, I would tattoo my mom. But I don't know what. But I just know that initially she wasn't super stoked on it, but it seems like she doesn't. I genuinely feel like she actually supports me 100% now with whatever I do.
That's beautiful. So. I love that. All right, and then an easy last question. This is the easiest question you've got all day. You're on death row, you get one last meal. What is it?
Spaghetti. You want to know why?
Spaghetti. I do want to know why.
This great vivid memory of my dad just dropping my face into the bowl of spaghetti.
Really? Is that a real answer? Because your dad
shoved. And then
spaghetti.
I threw the meatballs all over the room. It was hilarious. It was
oh
great.
My God. So spaghetti.
Spaghetti, baby. Italian.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you. And if you want to find DMART, you can find him on Instagram at
DMART.denaro. DEMART. DENARO.
And if you have time, connect with DMART and come to Bishop. It's a magical place. I'm sure he'd love to tattoo you, show you around, and connect with you on a dope level about art and life and all kinds of things. So thank you, DMART. Much love to you, and I'll see you next time.
Thank you, Aris.
Peace.